Okay, so this morning we're going to continue from yesterday, obviously, and we're still working on the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort. And we have looked at a number of ways so far how to deal with the mind, how to use wisdom in dealing with the mind, how to deal with ill will specifically. We had a look at that. And today I wanted to have a look at how to regard sense pleasures and how to deal. This is one way of dealing with sensual craving on the Buddhist path. How to regard these things, how to look at them, and how to kind of guide the mind slightly away from that and towards kind of even higher states of mind, higher happinesses, if you like, higher types of pleasure. So this is what this is about. It's not about kind of getting disgusted with sense pleasures or anything like that. It's just a kind of a natural movement towards something higher. That's really all it is about. It doesn't mean that from now on you cannot enjoy your food or anything like that. That would be terrible. It just means that you're kind of leaning in the right direction here. So this is the Potalya Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it gives a series of similes. I always like to read this one out on the retreats because it's very kind of vivid and very clear in many ways, and gives nice similes on how to regard sensual craving, if you like. Yeah. So this is how it goes. A householder. This is the Buddha. He is talking to a householder. This householder is called Potalya. And he's giving him this fairly profound teaching on sense pleasures. Householder, suppose a dog, overwhelmed by hunger and weakness, was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually, that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So one thing to remember when we read out these similes here is that the word sensual pleasures in Pali is kama. Kama, not the same as kamma. Kamma is action. Kama is sensual pleasure. This word refers both to the subjective feeling of craving, right, desire, but it also refers to the objects of the senses. So it's all the objects, all the things we possess, all the things we own, all the things we enjoy. That's also an aspect of karma. So both of these sides are part of sensual pleasures here. So what is happening here? What is happening here is this poor dog, right, who is hoping to get a fill, hoping to get some nice meat or whatever from this butcher's shop. And all it gets is this taste, right? The taste of blood. And then it runs on to the next one. And he gets another taste of blood at the next butcher's shop. And never really gets satisfied. There's never really any fulfillment. Never any satiation of that hunger, that thing that it actually is looking for. And this is what sensuality is about, says the Buddha, right? You are running from one thing to the other one. And every time you kind of get your fill, it doesn't take long before the craving re-arises, right? And every time you have a nice meal or whatever, and afterwards you feel kind of dull and kind of sort of semi-satisfied with that meal. But there's no real depth to that satisfaction. And because there's no real depth to it, craving re-arises soon again. So you keep on running around. This is what craving is about. There is no end point to this. It just goes on and on forever. And as you search, as you crave, and as you look for the object that will satisfy, your craving actually grows as a consequence of that. So it gets worse. And you run around even faster. And it doesn't really get you anywhere. And this is the exact opposite of meditation. Meditation, when it becomes really deep and it becomes profound, it is satisfying. You stay in the present moment. Craving begins to disappear, right? Gradually, craving settles down. And eventually, there is no more craving at all. And there's this complete satisfaction with what you have. You are in this beautiful state where there is no desire. All there is just joy and happiness. And there is a sense of fulfillment. You feel fulfilled. Craving is a sense of lack, right? It's a natural sense of lack, always seeking something else to fill you up. This time, there is no lack anymore. You are complete. You feel fulfilled for the first time. This is the distinction here. So we want to avoid being like this poor dog running around forever and ever, never really finding true satisfaction in life. Why is it that we keep on running around if there is no true satisfaction? Right? Why is it? What's the point of running? And it's just the same point as it is for the dog. The dog gets some taste of blood. It's better than nothing, right? You need something to make life worthwhile, and that something which makes life worthwhile is some degree of happiness. We need happiness in our life, and if that happiness does not come from the true satisfaction of meditation or something profound, then you will have to find that happiness somewhere else, and that will be in the sensual world. So we'd rather have that happiness which is conjoined with craving than having no happiness at all. That's just natural, because we need something to make life meaningful. We are feeling beings. Because we feel, we need to satisfy those feelings to some extent. This is the dependent arising, right? Dependent arising from feeling conditions craving. Because we feel, that very nature of feeling means that we want to satisfy and control those feelings. So that is the simile of the skeleton, the dog running around, never really finding satisfaction. And that is what the Buddha says. This is roughly how people are in regard to the sensual things of the world. So there you are. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away. And then other vultures, herons or hawks, pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death and deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures, or here perhaps sensual objects, have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this idea that these birds, they are fighting over sensuality. There's a sensual object. There's something that one bird wants, but if one bird wanted, all birds want it. All the birds are seeking for the same thing. And because of that, they fight over it, right? And if you don't let go of it, then, of course, eventually you will suffer enormously in that fight. You might even die as a consequence. And it's exactly the same thing with the sensual objects of the world. We tend to fight over things. We are competitors, right? We want the same partner. We are kind of attracted to the same people. We are attracted to the same job. We are attracted to the same whatever it is in life. And then we end up being rivals over these things. And because we are rivals, a lot of suffering happens as a consequence of that rivalry. So the world of sensual pleasure is a world that is inherently in disharmony. Inherently, there is a sense of fighting over things, always being in competition with each other. We compete for the jobs. We compete for so many things in life. And this is, I think, a very important insight to understand about sensuality. As long as there is sensuality, there's also going to be conflict. Conflict is a consequence, in large part, of sensual pleasures. To make that point, there are some other suttas where the Buddha talks about how conflict arises. I think you probably understand it to some extent already, but I thought it might be nice to have a look at one of those suttas. It's the next sutta on the list, where the Buddha talks about how conflict and for that reason also ill will and cruelty and all these things arises as a consequence of this. And this is from the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. This is a discourse on origination called the Nidana Sanghita in Pali. And this is how the Buddha describes this. And so, Ananda, feeling conditions craving. Craving conditions seeking. Seeking conditions acquisition. Acquisition conditions decision making. Decision making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachments conditions possessiveness is a better translation than appropriation. Possessiveness. And possessiveness conditions avarice or miserliness or stinginess. And that stinginess conditions the guarding of possessions. And because of the guarding of possessions, there arise the taking up of stick and swords, quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other bad, unwholesome qualities. So this is a problem, right? Once you crave, because of that craving, you acquire things. You become possessive of those things that you acquire. When you become possessing is attachment. And because you are attached to stuff and other people want it too, or whatever, then there is, as a consequence, there is fights and all kind of problems. And I think one of the most obvious cases where you can see that in the world is when people are going to inherit something from their parents, right? And very often you find people are arguing over inheritance. That's a kind of classic example which you see all the time. And sometimes you see the more wealthy the family is, the more they argue over what they have, right? You think there should be enough for everybody, but actually it's often the fact that you are attached which is the problem and not the fact that there is enough for everyone. And the world life is often like that. And if you start to look at carefully at what is going on in the world, what is going on in your own mind and going on a large scale in terms of wars, in terms of conflict between people, a lot of it is rooted in desire, in craving, in attachments, in wanting to control things, right? Remember that the desire to control is often also rooted in craving. We want to control the world. We want to control the oil supply to our economy, right? Why is that? Well, so people can, you know, people can enjoy, or people can, satisfy their desires. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. So a lot of these problems in the world, I think, are rooted in, ultimately, in craving and desire. That's a very useful thing to remember, because it's a bit off-putting when you start to realize that, so many problems come from this particular thing. So that is the second simile used by the Buddha for about sensual objects and attachments and the problems that arise with that. Then we have the third one here. Householders, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch? Wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have the simile of the grass torch. It burns you. These things, this is hot, right? And the craving is something hot. It's something that burns you inside, in a psychological sense. And here you pick up the grass torch, and obviously a grass torch has a certain value. A grass torch, it lights up in the dark, right? You can see where you're going. So it obviously has a certain value. And that is also sensual pleasures. They have a certain value. There's a certain amount of happiness to be gotten from that. But then if you go against the wind, it doesn't take long before you get burned by that same grass torch. And this is one of those, again, this is about dependent arising. We just saw this before. You crave for the pleasant feelings, you want to avoid the bad feelings. Because you crave, you go out into the world trying to search for those things that will satisfy your craving, that will, you know, make life we make it easier for you to fulfill that aspiration which the craving gives rise to. And that is that searching in the world, right? Looking for things, looking for a partner in life, looking for friends, looking for possessions, a house, all of that. That is where attachment arises. And as soon as you are attached, you are vulnerable to suffering straight away. Attachment is kind of the basis for being vulnerable to suffering. So this is the problem. And so it doesn't take long. As soon as craving arises, not far behind that comes suffering. It arises because of the attachment. It arises because of that problem. Not only that, but it's actually suffering in its own right. The very heat of the craving itself. And this might be part of the simile here. The very heat of that craving actually is a painful state. A lot of the pleasure of sensuality is that craving subsides, right? That is a lot of the pleasure of it. The craving disappears. That is a very important part of the pleasure of sensuality. And it's very hard to be able to distinguish between what is the aspect of the pleasure, which is just the craving disappearing, and what is the kind of the pleasure in its own right, if you like, in sensuality. These things are so closely connected to each other, it's very hard to distinguish. But it's kind of weird. We crave for things just so that we can get rid of the craving, right? It's kind of strange. That's, in a sense, how it works. And then there's a little bit of pleasure on top of that. Anyway, so that is the simile of the grass torch. And now we come to perhaps the kind of strongest of the similes here. So this is how it goes. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So again, there is this idea that with sensual pleasures there is craving, and wherever there is craving there's a sense of burning, right? You're literally burning inside. Burning with desire is kind of an English expression also, isn't it? You're burning with desire, and this is the problem here. But very strong comparison to a charcoal pit is almost, it's very hard to kind of wrap your mind fully around that. Unless you go up to a higher level, unless you get the stage of samadhi, and then you can see down and you can understand for the first time why that is called a charcoal pit, because you have gone beyond sensual pleasures, and you can understand why craving is so painful in its own right. So this, to understand this better, there's another sutta, and this is the one that follows after the one we saw before, and this is called the Magandhya Sutta, MN 75, and this gives a more detailed description of this particular what is going on here. And this is again very, very graphic. It's, you know, it really kind of drives the point home. it comes just after this other sutta, I think. It's not there. Okay. It's not there. Okay. I have it. Okay. You haven't got it. Okay. Never mind. I'll read it out for you anyway, so you can just listen to this sutta. It's called the Magandhya Sutta. Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Cauterizing means you're literally burning your limbs over the charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a physician to treat him. the physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama, why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Magandhya? Is it only now that that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gotama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too, that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper, with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. And the Buddha replies, so too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, those sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch, they acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. So that is the Buddha's description in detail about sensual pleasures and why it is a problem. It is a problem because we don't see clearly. We don't see what is going on. We don't understand. We crave, and because you crave, that craving is actually what distorts your outlook. Craving makes it feel like this is the way to go. This is what you are supposed to be moving towards. Craving is the problem. Craving changes your perception of reality. So why do we crave if it changes our perception of reality? We crave because we haven't got the higher happiness. We haven't got the happiness which is kind of way, way beyond the happiness of the ordinary sensuality. And because of that, we need some happiness, so we still crave for these things, even though they are hot. Just like the leper, right? The leper, his craving is very strong. He has all these wounds all over his hands and his arms or whatever. So, and they are incredibly itchy. He's scratching. There are worms in there. It's terrible. And because the craving is so strong to get rid of that, he burns it. And that gets rid of some of the craving. So it feels nice because of that. Right? It feels nice because some of the craving disappears as a consequence, even though it actually is painful. In the same way, because we desire these objects, craving arises. That craving subsides a little bit as we acquire the objects of our craving. And because the craving subsides, that is a large part of the pleasure of sensuality. So it feels like it's really nice, but actually a large part of the pleasure is just the craving itself disappearing. So we crave, so a craving can disappear, right? It's weird, but that's a large part how it works. It's not quite like that. There is also a degree of pleasure in sensuality. There's a little bit of pleasure there as well. It's not quite as bad as the fire, because there is some pleasure beyond the craving. And in fact, it says in the suttas that if you attain a deep state of samadhi and all craving is gone, actually the objects of the senses are better than if you don't and if you have craving there. So by abandoning craving, actually you are able to better appreciate those pleasures of the world, like food or whatever it is, right? So without craving, it actually is better, which is kind of weird. But because you know that there is a higher pleasure, and because you understand the danger in sensuality, you don't crave for them anymore. You're just able to enjoy them for what they are without craving for them. So this is how this works. But again, remember that this is not about what I'm saying here is not about kind of to create an aversion towards sensual pleasures. Not at all. Everybody needs their pleasures. So please enjoy the pleasures in the world to whatever extent is necessary to have a good life. But just remember that there is something higher. There's something beyond this. And when you understand that there is something higher, which is really fulfilling, really peaceful, really nice, and you start, of course, to get an idea about that in your meditation practice, it changes a little bit how you view things, and it makes you aspire for something more rather than just aspire for the sensual pleasures of the world. And this is what this is about. It's just about to change your attitude a little bit, change your view a little bit, to see things in a different way, not to get an aversion towards things that really are necessary for us to be able to enjoy life. So that is an important kind of rider for this whole thing, because if you don't take that into account, then you're going to have a very miserable life if you never can enjoy anything in life anymore. So that is that powerful simile of the charcoal pit, and then we'll have a look at the remainder similes of the sutta. And the next one here, the Buddha says, householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So the sensual pleasures, the sensual objects of the world, it's like a dream. And if you consider this, very often we dream about things, we want to get this, we want to get that. And once you get these things, and sometimes often you don't get them at all, but if you get them, it is the satisfaction is very short-lasting. Things never really live up quite to the dreams that we have, even when we get those things. But most of the time we dream and we don't even get what the dream tells us about, what the dream is all about. When we are young, we think about what life is going to be like, right? You dream about a career, you're going to have such and such a nice partner in life, everything is going to be like this. It never turns out the way we think it's going to be. At least it didn't for me. It turned out very differently for me, that's for sure. We have these dreams about life, what it's going to be like. And it always is different. And when it is different, what happens is that we change the goalposts a little bit. So we start to dream little different dreams, right? Not quite as ambitious as when we are very young, you have very ambitious dreams. So you tone down your ambitions a little bit, but you still dream about something. And that doesn't quite work out either, right? So again, you change your dreams. Everything is much more ordinary, much more boring than what we think things are going to be like in our dreams. Our dreams are never fulfilled. Once you wake, one day you wake up, you think, well, it didn't actually work out. One day you die, you're going to die, right? And then when you die, you think back on your life. And actually, most of those things that you aspired for, most of those things you thought life was all about, it never happened. The whole thing was basically just a dream. It's a very powerful, I think, and useful kind of reflection, this idea of the dream, how most of the pleasures of sensuality are like in our mind. They are a fantasy. They're not actually a reality. There is a third sutta, which I also, you may not have, because I'm starting to realize that I may have suttas that you haven't got. But this is a sutta to Samiddhi, Sanyutta Nikaya 120. It should be part roughly in the same area as this sutta. And this is another sutta which kind of makes this point in a slightly different way here, which I think is interesting here. This is from the Sanyutta Nikaya. It's called Samiddhi Sutta. So this is how it goes. I don't know if you have it. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha, the hot springs park. And if you go to Rajagaha today, the hot spring park is still there. It's amazing. People are still bathing in those hot springs 2,500 years later on. Then the wanderer Samiddhi, having risen at the first flush of dawn, went to the hot springs to bathe. Having bathed in the hot springs, he came back out. He stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata, a deva, a divine being, if you like, of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire hot springs, approached the Venerable Samiddhi. Having approached, she stood in the air and addressed the Venerable Samiddhi in verse. I'm not sure if it is a she or a he, but anyway, they have chosen she here. And then what this devata says, says the following. Without having enjoyed, you seek alms, bhikkhu. You don't seek alms after you have enjoyed. First enjoy, bhikkhu, then seek alms. Don't let the time pass you by. And then he replies, I do not know what the time might be. The time is hidden and cannot be seen. Hence, without enjoying, I seek alms. Don't let the time pass me by. Then that devata alighted on the earth and said to the Venerable Samiddhi, you have gone forth while young, bhikkhu, a lad with black hair, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, without having dallied with sensual pleasures. Enjoy human sensual pleasures, bhikkhu. Do not abandon what is directly visible in order to pursue what takes time. And then the monk replies, I have not abandoned what is directly visible, friend, in order to pursue what takes time. I have abandoned what takes time in order to pursue what is directly visible. For the Blessed One, friend, has stated that sensual pleasures are time-consuming, full of suffering, full of despair, and the danger in them is still greater. While this Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. So this, again, is one of those interesting little suttas which are kind of counterintuitive. You know, you can see the point of the devata here. He's saying, well, you're pursuing this kind of pie in the sky, you kind of this nibbana and all these kind of states that are promised by the Buddha. You don't know what it's all about. And you have abandoned the happiness that is directly in front of you, right? Go out into the world. You are young. Get a girlfriend or whatever and enjoy yourself, for goodness sake. Why are you wasting your time? That is what this deva is saying. Or this is like the tempter coming down and saying, you know, enjoy life to the full. And that is kind of natural. It seems sensible, right? I once asked some people, you know, what do you think about this? Yeah, that makes sense. You know, this is that is a sensible thing this deva is saying. And it kind of makes sense, right? We can all relate to that to some degree. Yeah. And that is why the response from this bhikkhu Samiddhi is so baffling, because actually he's saying it's the other way around. It is sensual pleasures that have to do with time, and the Dhamma is right now. So why is that? How can that be the case, that the sensual pleasures take time? What we've just been seeing is like a dream, right? Craving is a desire, is always about the future, is always about what we are going to get. And sensual desire, inherent in sensual pleasures, is desire and craving, is almost always there as part of our pursuit and our indulgence in sensual pleasures. Craving is always there, always about the future, always about something else, never about the present moment, right? When you think about it, it's actually pretty obvious. So it seems like it's here, it seems like it's for us to grab, but it's always a little bit ahead of us, always running after it, never quite getting there. Whereas the Dhamma, and this is kind of the power of the Dhamma, if you do it right, if you do something good now, and you do it in the right way, with the right way of thinking, you get the result like that. Right now, there's no craving involved. Right now, you feel happy. Right now, you feel the result of that action which has been done rightly. If you got a little bit of happiness out of the metta meditation, for example, straight away you feel that happiness right here, right now. There's nothing to do with the future anymore. So this is the happiness, the type of happiness that we are pursuing are very different types of happiness. The happiness of the Dhamma is a present moment happiness you experience in the moment, and whereas the happiness of sensuality is always in the future. And that is the distinction here. And of course, yes, it is true that that happiness of the Dhamma, sometimes it is kind of in the future, right? Because we are also kind of aspiring for something higher. But always, there's always some degree of happiness that we can tap into right away. So that is the simile of the dream for you. All of these things are really powerful things, right? They're very different from how people normally think about the world. And the right way to think about these things is not to despair at the fact that sensuality perhaps may not be as wonderful as we had thought, but rather it's the right way of thinking about it is to think, wow, there actually is something much, much greater in this world, a sense of real satisfaction, real contentment, right, that can be attained. And to kind of feel the wonder and the marvel of that, that there is something so beautiful available to each one of us. Okay, so let us look at the next one. Very, very briefly, because I spoke about this one yesterday. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Right? So you borrow that nice carriage and you borrow that jewelry, and in the meantime, while you're borrowing it, you get attached to it. And then, of course, you get really disappointed when people take them back again afterwards. And just as I was saying yesterday, everything in life is borrowed. Everything in life is just rented for a short time, and then it has to be given back. Given back to what? Given back to nature. It is nature that reclaims its things. It doesn't really belong to you. It just belongs to this, to the natural order in one way or another. You cannot control them. In the end, you have to let it all go. So a very nice way of looking at everything you own in life. Here you can see that sensual pleasures refer mostly to the objects of the senses, right? You cannot control those objects. The objects have their own, a life of their own, so to speak, and they have to follow their own laws of the universe, their own conditions as a consequence. Okay, the last one of these similes. Householder, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. He entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree. So let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. And taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove and saw that tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree. So let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. What do you think, householders? If that first man who had climbed that tree doesn't come down quickly when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this man who enters this grove, right? And you can imagine the grove itself is like the world, right? The world of sensual objects, the world of sensual pleasures. And we're kind of wandering around in this world, looking for objects that will satisfy us, looking for relationships, looking for things to own, looking for pleasures in the world. This is what the world is like. And as we wander around in this world, sometimes we see something attractive, right? Something that we would like. We see this tree laden with fruit, right? Wow, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. So you climb that tree, right? Maybe it's a mango tree, right? With beautiful ripe mangoes. And you get up into this tree and you start eating all these beautiful mangoes in the tree. And then that fact, the eating of the mangoes, this is like getting intoxicated. One of the things, important things the Buddha talks about in the suttas is that these pleasures, they are intoxicating. We get intoxicated by them. You lose your sense of time and place, right? You lose your sense of what is right and wrong. And all you can think of is just eating these wonderful mangoes. So you're eating all these wonderful mangoes, and in the meantime, somebody else comes along, right? And that person also wants mangoes. He probably doesn't see the fellow in top of the tree, so thinks, okay, I'm going to chop this tree down. But because you are intoxicated, because you have lost your sense of lost your mindfulness, you don't really know what's happening anymore, you don't see that man at the bottom of the tree, right? You become careless. You become heedless. You become pamada. Instead of being apamada, you become pamada. And because of that pamada, you are no longer aware of the danger that is around you. And this is danger is then the fellow who comes and cuts down the tree. And unless you regain your mindfulness quickly, unless you kind of get your mind out of that intoxication, you will fall down and you will suffer as a consequence. And this again is just a way of showing how attachment to sensual objects must always end in pain. One way or another, it has to end in pain. Attachment and pain are two sides of the same coin. You cannot avoid some degree of pain once you are attached. So the idea here is to see that, and once you start to understand that, you loosen your grip a little bit, and you start to find that happiness somewhere else. So this is that, again, that simile of, seeing what is, here the intoxication of sensual pleasures is part of the part of this particular simile as I see it. And one of the interesting things here is, well, how do we, what is it that happens when we actually gain a state of samadhi? And when we gain a state of samadhi, you are letting go of all the sensual pleasures of the world. And you are kind of rising above the forest. And this is another simile found elsewhere in the suttas, where you walk on top of a mountain. And once you get to the top of the mountain, you can look down and you get a perspective and you see what is going on. You can understand those sensual pleasures for the first time because like you are above and you are looking down. And it is the same simile as you find in one of Ajahn Brahm's books. I don't know if Ajahn Brahm read it in the suttas, first of all, or whether it was just a kind of obvious that was going on. But you may remember, Ajahn Brahm has this, it's a very nice story. When he went to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, right, these ancient Mayan pyramids that you have there, very old ones. And he has a story where he was going through the jungle, right? He was going down the rivers, kind of where everything was so dense, and going on the little jungle tracks with a cart or whatever, and there's jungle everywhere. You can only see a few meters in front of you and behind of you. So everything is so dense. And then eventually they arrive at these pyramids. And Ajahn Brahm, he was there in the 1970s, I think. This was before it was kind of recognized the value of these things, and there was nobody around, right? Now I'm sure there's a fence around everything. You have to pay entry ticket and all these kind of things. Those days there was nothing. So he just kind of wanders up this pyramid, right? And walks to the top. And when you get to the top of the pyramid, you are elevated above the canopy of the forest. And suddenly you can see to the horizon, you can see far away. And when you look down, you can see kind of the rivers down there, you can see the roads, and you suddenly understand what is happening. You understand the landscape. You're no longer blinded. You're no longer, everything now gets into perspective in a sense, whereas it wasn't before. And this is what happens when you get to samadhi. You get a perspective on the world, and especially you get a perspective on the sensual world, the world of the five senses and sensuality, and you see that for the first time. And here it is the same thing in the suttas, this idea that you climb this mountain, you get above it all, and then you look down, and then you understand. Then you understand the danger in that craving. You have gone beyond craving. For the first time in your life, you're fully satisfied, and you understand why craving and sensual pleasures never can bring that same kind of satisfaction, of fulfillment, of wholeness. You feel whole, right? That itch which is craving has been completely eradicated once and for all. Okay, so that is the all these, in my opinion, very beautiful similes, and they make it quite clear. When you kind of draw out the meaning of these similes, it becomes fairly clear what is going on with sensuality. And these are things to be reflected upon, and to see what you think about these things, whether they make any sense to you or not. And then gradually, that reflection changes your view a little bit, and that will have consequences down your track, and hopefully it will also help to boost your meditation as a consequence of that. That is really the purpose of all this. It is to boost your meditation practice, to subside the defilements a little bit, and then the consequence of that is always positive. Okay. So, what is next on your list there, Ananda? I'm getting a bit worried now that not everything is there. Huh? Yeah. Union. Okay, good. Okay. That's the next one of mine as well, so that's good. Okay, so this is another sutta on sensuality. And this is more directed at relationships, specifically romantic relationships. I always thought this was quite interesting, this particular sutta, when I first read it, because it shows you a different way of understanding relationships and why relationships are so attractive. So let us have a quick look at this. I don't think it should take too long. It's a fairly simple sutta. We'll have a look at this, and then we'll conclude after that. Because I will teach you a Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement. Listen, and what is that Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement? A woman, bhikkhus, attends internally to her feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspects, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. She becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, she attends externally to a man's masculine faculty, his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspects, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentations. She becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, she desires union externally. And she also desires a pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are delighted with their femininity enter upon union with men. It is in this way that a woman does not transcend her femininity. A man, bhikkhus, attends internally to his masculine faculty, to his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspects, his masculine desires, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. He becomes excited and takes delight in them. Excited by them and taking delight in them, he attends externally to a woman's feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspects, her feminine desires, her feminine voice, and her feminine ornamentation. He becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, he desires union externally, and he also desires the pleasures and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are delighted with their masculinity enter upon union with women. It is in this way that a man does not transcend his masculinity. So this this is basically just a different way of understanding why it is that we enter upon romantic relationships, right? And it's fascinating here. Suddenly, the focus here is on yourself. It is really how you look upon yourself that decides how you look upon the people around you. So if you look upon yourself as a gender, if you look upon yourself as a man and a woman, and you take delight in those things that make you either a man or a woman, that is why you go into relationships with the opposite gender afterwards. It's fascinating. So right, every time you look at yourself in the mirror and you think of yourself as being of that gender and you make sure that your appearance is right or whatever, you are reinforcing that sense that you will all, that will eventually end up in a relationship with somebody else. So it is interesting that it's actually how we look upon ourselves that is the root of the problem here, according to how the Buddha teaches. And this is one thing you notice that with people who are very kind of have gone a long way on the spiritual path, often they lose very much of their gender identity. Someone who has very profound meditation and deep insight, you see some of these people, and it's almost as if they have almost lost that gender identity. You can't really place them. They're neither a man or a woman. They are somewhere in between. I mean, physically, they still look like a man or a woman, but the way they act, the way they conduct themselves, the way they speak, everything has kind of lost that sense of identity in terms of gender. And I think you will be able to see that in people who have gone a long way on the Buddhist path. So the more gender identity you have, the less, in a sense, you have. The less you have walked on the spiritual path, and as you walk that spiritual path, the less gender identity you tend to have as well. And you can hasten that by not focusing so much on that aspect of you, which is either a man or a woman. You can hasten that decline, hasten the reduction in that sort of attachment that you have towards the opposite gender. It's a very useful way of thinking, right? You don't actually look at that so much anymore. You don't think about that. And of course, as a monastic, this is very important. Because if you don't do that, you're going to be in trouble as a monastic. So, yes. And of course, this is also one of the things that you see in meditation practice. As your meditation comes more profound, you come to the point when you leave this whole gender identity gets left behind, right? And this is what the deep states of samadhi are all about, the Brahma Viharas, where you have very profound meditation. At that point, there is no gender identity anymore. You go beyond that. And you say that if a being gets reborn in that particular realm, there is no distinction anymore. There are no male and female. It is just beings, right? You're just a being. You're just this pure, you're full of love, but it is a universal love towards everyone. There's no longer a distinction between male and female at that stage. So this is what happens. It's exactly the same thing that happens as you kind of move upwards in the spiritual hierarchy. You get to the point when all of this kind of is erased and isn't there anymore. Okay, and of course, the idea is that that's a good thing, right? It's actually very pleasant. It's very nice to get rid of that distinction, which often causes so much trouble and so much thing. It's not something negative. It's actually a very positive experience. And then we have the opposite, and this comes next here, and that is very obvious what is going to happen here, because it's just the opposite of what we have seen. This is how union comes about, and how does disengagement come about? A woman, bhikkhus, does not attend internally to her feminine faculty and all the feminine aspects and to her feminine ornamentation. She does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them. She does not attend externally to a man's masculine faculty, masculine aspects, etc., and his masculine ornamentation. She does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them. She does not desire union externally, nor should nor does she desire the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are not delighted by the feminine, in fact, by the femininity, become disengaged from men. It is in this way that a woman transcends her femininity. A man, because, does not attend internally to his masculine faculty, his masculine aspects, his masculine ornamentation. He does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them. He does not attend externally to a woman's feminine faculty, her feminine aspects, her feminine ornamentation. He does not become excited by these and take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them. He does not desire union externally, nor does he desire the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are not delighted by the masculinity become disengaged from women. It is in this way that a man transcends his masculinity. This is how disengagement comes about. This, because, is the Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement. Okay, so I will leave it at that for this morning. There's probably quite a bit for you to think about there. These are the sort of things you can think about again and again. And as you think about this, gradually it matures inside of you. And gradually you get a more clear understanding what these things actually mean. And this is one reason why I like to read out some of these suttas. I like to read them out every year. And if nobody else likes it, at least I like it. So there you are. Very selfish of me. So this afternoon we're going to start looking at Satipatthana and right mindfulness. So that will be coming up this afternoon. And we'll see you then.